This is Writing Lessons, and I'm your host, Silas House. In each episode of Writing Lessons, we look at a different topic of creative writing. And today, we're focusing on what makes a great poem. Our guest for this episode is Kathleen Driscoll, one of our most acclaimed poets, whose work has been published in The New Yorker, Rattle, The Southern Review, Shenandoah, and many other fine publications. From 2019 to 22, she served as chair of the board of directors of the Association of Writers and Writing Programs, better known as AWP, the largest professional organization of creative writers in the U.S. She is currently the chair of the Naslin Mann Graduate School of Writing at Spalding University, and we'll get to some of the other things she does later. Thank you so much for being with me today, Kathleen.
It's always great to be with you, Silas. I'm happy to be here.
So we'll dive right in. What makes a great poem?
I think when people ask me this, I remember the great words of William Carlos Williams, who we don't read very much anymore, but who was important to me as a younger poet. He talked about poems as engines, small engines. And I think it's important, and one of the most challenging things about writing poems is that you have a lot of different complexities going on at once, and you have to manage all those complexities into a unified kind of poem. So when I talk about poems, I talk about them needing tension, and that could be an argument between two people, or a misunderstanding, or a wanting to come to an understanding, even if one person is only implied in a poem. It could be a conflict within self. It can be a conflict in situation there. So I think we don't talk about conflict enough in poems, and that's what holds them together. There's a really great essay that I always rely on, and I think it's helpful for everyone, called The Four Temperaments of Poetry. I think that's the title. I might be slightly off, by Gregory Orr. And it's been around forever. But what I love about it is it talks about the different ways and the different things that poems have to do when they come together. And he takes some Aristotelian ideas and brings them forward about 2,500 years in a way that we might better understand them. But he talks about there being needing to be a sort of limiting side for a poem, which is like a poem. Something that we might read about Apollo, a classic sort of structure, whatever. And in that limiting side of poems, we have structure and story. It's, even poems are stories. So they have to have a beginning and middle end, even if it's kind of an implied story. So, and then on the other side is the Dionysian side, or what he calls the limitless side. And that's got music and imagination. And so one is sort of tightly put together and held and unified, and the other is fighting against that, trying to be a little more musical, free floating, and mysterious, those things that you can't quite put into words. So when all those things come together, then I think you have a better chance of making a unified poem. And that's a lot of parts to manage. It takes a long time to do that, but it never fails that when I'm giving a lecture about this, and I like to talk about it a lot. So when I'm giving a lecture about this, and I say, "What are you? What kind of writer are you? Are you a writer who's more on the side of Apollo, your classic? You want to get to the beginning of the story, the middle story, the end of the story?" And sometimes you're in a workshop and people say, "I want more. I like this. I understand where it's going, but I want more." Then what they're asking for is to add in more of the limitless side, I think, too. That sort of side that makes beautiful language and has beautiful imagery and those sorts of things. So anyway, when I ask people, I'm like, "What side are you on?" Almost everybody knows what side they're on, at least in the beginning of their writing. Like, I was really on the side of limiting. I was really into narrative. I actually thought I was going to be like a short story writer or something, but that was crazy, crazy idea. Now I think about it. But no offense, Silas. I just mean I didn't have the talent to do it, nor the temperament to do it. But anyway, people know. They know what they are. And so it's a great diagnostic tool that Gregory Orr has, because what he's teaching you is, well, okay, so Kathleen, in the beginning of your career, you're pretty limiting in the tools that you're drawn toward. So in order to unify a poem, or make any piece of literature, not just poems, to make that more full, more unified, more satisfying to the reader, then you need to strengthen those other muscles there. And so people who are on the side of Dionysus, or the limitless, they might be not so interested with plot or structure, and they're sort of all over the place, and there's lots of images, and you can't quite put them together. You're not quite sure how they work together. Then that person needs to work on the structural side to some extent. So I find it a really useful kind of way to talk, particularly for beginning writers. And the thing about this great tool is that you can use it with high school writers. You can amp it up the conversation for undergraduates. And then I use it a ton in even for my graduate students, who qu know quite a bit about poetry before they even get into the program here. So yeah, I don't know. I just went off on a tangent. I
No,
don't know.
that's all wonderful. I mean, that's what this podcast is. You're doing exactly what the title of the podcast is. It's writing lessons, and
Yeah.
I just learned a whole lot. So
Oh,
I'm
right.
sure our listeners did too. Well, I mean, you may have already mentioned some of this,
Yeah.
but let's go beyond that. I know many poets who would say that you changed their lives as their teacher. So if we're attending your poetry class, what's the number one thing we're going to learn in there? What are we going to take away from it more than anything?
Well, I think that my big emphasis and my time trying to teach students is really focused around revision, to tell you the truth. I mean, I don't have a lot of prompts. I'm not really into making prompts. Some people are really great at it. I'm not, but what I am interested is helping each student understand, okay, you have a draft now, and now how do we unify this and make this into the best poem that it can be? And so there are lots of ways. Some of the ways are, I have them create a revision checklist, things that some people are better at things some bit than others. I was talking about the limiting the limitless, some fall on either side. So there are lots of things that you can go back and check in your poems, and I want them to make a list. And I was just talking to a student, an MFA student the other day, who said those things that we've been talking about, I've integrated them, and so I'm better at them. I'm like, okay, well, let's add more stuff to the list. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about writing. It's never, we've never learned at all, which is, what most of us are after when we're writers. The pursuit of happiness is the ability to continue to learn and be curious and bring new things into our craft. So, I'll talk about them particularly and say, does your poem have a beginning and middle and end? Most people don't realize that poems really have to move. They can't just stay in the same place. All writing has to move, but particularly poems, I think. You can't just stay in the same place. You could go back to that place at the end of the poem that you started in, but you're in a different place, if that makes sense, because you've gone through all this exploration. So beginning and middle and end. I think it's important for people to know why they've come to the page. I think it's wonderful to write poems for yourself, but if you're writing for publication, I think we don't think enough about the gift to the reader. What is it that the reader's going to take from this particular poem that they would get from nobody else, no other poem of any other time? And it could be that it's in conversation with another poem that goes back historically or whatever. But, we need to think about our readers, and poets are not really taught to think that way. We're taught to think whatever we put down is going to be fabulous, and people should just bow down before us and be appreciative of it. But so little things like the line is what makes poetry different. And I'm not very popular for saying this. It's the only conservative bone I have in my body, but I don't really think prose poems exist. I think if we had understood that there was such an entity as a lyric essay or flash fiction, we might have called it that, not prose poems, because the thing that makes a poem is the line, and every line should have its moment. And there are lots of reasons for turning a line at the end of the right margin, right hand margin. And I think that's confusing to some people because they think, well, I don't know how to treat a line, but the challenge of it is there's lots of different ways, also the fun of it, to turn a line. So you may want to turn a line so that you have compressed meaning in the moment of the line. And then you turn the line, you understand that you're building onto that moment, or you're taking that moment into a different direction. So best example is one of mine, sorry. One of my poems that I talk about, that's in Next Door to the Dead. And I talk about it's about a deer that's been hit in the side of the road and that's being removed. So I talk about the deer being lifted into the grave, All right. And so then I cut the line, I turn the line, and the next line is Serious Sky. So I get both meanings. If poetry is about compression, then that play with compressed meaning, new meaning, echoing meaning, amplifying meaning is really pretty fun and worth understanding, I think, too. I think people need to watch out, particularly beginning poets, but not always. People who are into it don't think enough about varying syntax. They build sentences in the same way. He said, she said, they said, you know, that sort of thing. That's important. I talk about the differences between sentences, cumulative sentences, periodic sentences, what they do, and why we might use them. I want titles to do work in poems. That's your first introduction. It shouldn't be simply decorative or something that is a sort of toss-away title. The title is the first time your editor, if you're sending poems out, is going to see what you're about. You want to set a tone, maybe to play against, you know, in terms of contrast or whatever. But, you know, some people feel like they're better at titles than others.
I failed to mention this in your intro because you have so many accolades, but you're also editor-in-chief at Good River Review. So what are the major things in a poem that would cause you to immediately reject them?
The title wasn't interesting to me. A poem that begins in a way that it's very familiar to me. My teacher, who used to be my boss too, Sina Jean or Naslin, she had this wonderfully genteel way of saying something was cliche. She's like, that feels very familiar to me. That was always so nice. I've kind of picked up on that. But you know, you want to understand too in the beginning, just as in a short story, what the antecedent for the poem is pretty early in the poem. Like what's the occasion for this? What happened right before you sat down to write this? Or what's happening, the tension of the thing that's making you sit down to write this? Call it an antecedent, call it an inciting moment, perhaps, whatever happens before the inciting moment, I guess, for a fiction writer. Creative nonfiction writer. So those are things. Fresh language. I don't want to see things phrased in the same way. If someone can turn a familiar phrase in a new way, I think that's always very clever. I mean, subject matter, lots of things.
Do you have forms that are particular favorites to write?
No, I don't. I have once in a while, I think it's good for students to practice the sonnet form when they begin. And the sonnet form has lots of entities that you can work with. But I think it's good to teach people about compression, which is so important in all writing, but particularly poetry, I think. And it really shows you, makes you fight for every word. You know, is this necessary? Is this not? I mean, going back to Aristotle, I mean, one of his principles of unity was that I call it the Aristotle Jenga principle. It's like if you could take something out, and the poem doesn't fall apart in your hands, then that thing that you took out doesn't need to be there anyway. I
Yes.
guess fiction writers, I hear them talking about killing their darlings. So I think that's somewhat similar. On the other hand, if you read the poem and something's missing, then you need to put that thing in. And so that's what unifies something. You don't want anything that's not necessary, and you don't want anything that's necessary not to be included in the poem either. And that's kind of a hard thing to learn. It just comes with poetic practice, I think. Unfortunately, and fortunately, I guess.
When I started out as a writer, I think I thought that revision was 10% of the process. Now I think that revision's 90% of the process.
I agree.
And so I'm so glad that, I had great teachers like in the MFA program and other people along the way who taught me that, because I do think it's something you need to be told more. It's not the easiest thing just to figure out on your own. So it's been so beneficial to me to learn the benefits of revision. And I'm an evangelist for that because I think not enough people, I think especially nowadays, I think the laptop has helped with this some. People will just, rip something out of the printer and it's ready to go. And that really bothers me.
I get kind of I cringe a little bit sometimes when I'll be at a reading and someone will be, I just wrote this on the way here, and I'm like,
Yes.
ugh.
Then don't read it.
Right. Make sure you really have it pulled together. But I know that's not a, I don't know. I guess that's sort of in our culture, right? I'm a virtuoso. I don't need to come back and shine this up or anything. Now, I don't think you want to polish the life out of something, and
No.
that's another thing you have to learn too when you're in revision. But I agree with you. And the revision is 90% of it. And I hate to sound so sanctimonious, but I think writers who are really driven to write are excited with the draft because now they can work on revision, right? That's when all the possibility happens, right? That's
That's
when play happens.
yeah, I mean that's the best part of it all. That's the satisfaction. My
Yeah.
a lot of times, especially with younger writers, they at a certain point in my classes, they'll say, "This isn't fun, but writing should be fun." And I say, "Writing should not be fun. I think writing should be satisfying, but not
Right.
fun. I don't like
Right.
the connotation of fun. It's too light. It's not serious
Right.
enough."
I agree with you. But if people want to write in their journals and I don't want to condescend, but write for their own personal pleasure. I mean, you can hardly go to the grocery store and I mean you could talk about poetry going up and down the aisle of the grocery store. People are like, I like to write poems. Do you read poems? No, but I like to write them.
Exactly.
And that's great. I don't want anybody who's doing any sort of artistic reach for something, especially in this day and age. I think the art is what makes us feel fully human in my mind. So, the more we want human beings feeling as human as they can, realizing their full potential of humanity. That would be my wish. Maybe I'm thinking of people who need to write poems.
Yes.
Be a lot better. Our world would be better, wouldn't it?
Definitely. Are there particular books that you think of as essential for writers who are hungry to learn more about craft? And while you think about that, I'll just say when I'm thinking about writing overall, I really love a book called Imaginative Writing by Janet Burroway. I also really love the little book, Mary Oliver's A Poetry Handbook for Poetry. I think it's a great like beginning book and even one to just look at occasionally. So are there books like that for you?
I think those are two really good, beautiful books to look at and to have and hold. There's one called The Practice of Poetry. I think it's Robin Baines' book. I'm not sure. But I know that some people need the door opened. But honestly, I think reading poetry is the best thing. When I actually had a student she's not even a student yet, but she was asking me about writer's block, which I'm not really sure I believe in. But I told her the thing that makes me want to write is to read really great poems. And
Yes.
I guess if I had a writing prompt, it would be to copy over poems. I mean, not even try to draft your own poems, but just copy them over and see what the writer's doing. I still do that. I mean, I've been, published my sixth or seventh book and whatever, and I still am like, I don't quite understand what Gerard Manley Hopkins is doing here. I want to go in and I'll just copy it over. I've got notebooks and notebooks of John Keats, Ode to a Nightingale, where I'm just trying to figure out what he's doing. So, I mean, it's not a very pat answer, I don't think, for you, but Emily Dickinson, Robert Frost is, kind of the times have caught up with him because there are many writers, poets, whatever, whom we're not sure we're supposed to read anymore because of their interactions with other people. But and Robert Frost might have been the first really to bring that point of view to us as readers. But I just think Robert Frost is an amazing poet to read. He just was so smart and knew so much and taught himself. It taught it all to himself,
I agree. The best lessons you'll ever learn are by reading what you want to write. I mean, as much as I have appreciated my teachers and my education and how much that made me a better writer, I think that if I'd never read a book, I could not write. Come on.
Right. Well, it would be like trying to write a symphony without listening to music. I mean, it's just when you think about it, it's just common sense to do that. I mean, I just feel like poetry is so complicated, as are the other literatures, but poetry is so complicated that it's kind of, I don't know that one book's gonna do it.
I think you are a remarkable reader of your poetry. Yet, honestly and unfortunately, so many writers are not great readers of their own work. Once someone has heard you read, when they read your poetry, they hear you. And that's a very good thing. Do you have any tips for reading your work aloud?
I do, but before I go into that, let me just say that you are a remarkable reader of your own work too. So I'm not, people might laugh if they know me very well, but I'm not really a ham and I'm not really a person that likes to hop on stage. I can do it and I'm happy to do it if I know what I'm talking about or I feel good about that. But I try to read what the poem says and I try to read the words. I love thinking about how a long vowel stays in the mouth. In the ear, in the eye, if you're reading on the page, much longer than an open vowel or a short vowel. And I love thinking about how short vowels have lots of air in them. One of the best poems, I think, for teaching me how to write is God's Grandeur by Gerard Manley Hopkins, which has the best sounds in it of any poem that I've ever read. And I've been reading a lot of poems my whole life, so that's a pretty wild statement, I understand, but I think people try to rush their poems. I think they don't read what's being said, so it's a sort of they're reading maybe what they perceive to be the meter. And I'm telling you, if the meter is just ba-bum, 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 then the meter's not that exciting anyway. So I don't know what you want. I don't think you want to write a meter like that. I mean, a pattern is made to be broken. So I was talking about the tension of poems before. So if I create a sort of iambic or monosyllabic line that's kind of hard to get through, then I want to find a really great place and really great sentiment to follow that up with, so that my sentiment will be different. One of the best examples of this, I think, also is Robert Hayden's Those Winter Sundays, which is often anthologized and whatever, but he really has this amazingly long line. You want me to read it? The long
Sure.
line? Okay. So this is a very famous poem by Robert Hayden, and I use it a lot, and I don't apologize for using it over and over again because it has so many wonderful lessons. But the first stanza is, "Sundays too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue black cold. Then, with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze." I love that long A right there and the way it elongates that. And then the next set, that's one sentence. It's a long sentence. It's like the dad, it's the form and the content are coming together, which is also something that excites me about poetry. So you have this long sentence because what the father's doing doesn't, it's not flipping a thermostat like in our houses. It's like a lot of care. It takes a lot of energy. He's been working every 6 days a week, and this is his morning. And so then the next sentence for that stanza is, "No one ever thanked him," which is a very short sentence, particularly short. You notice it's short because after that long sentence, so you have the pattern of the long sentence coming along, and then you have the short sentence, and the short sentence demands attention then because of the way it's been set up. And I just love that, because how long would it have taken to thank the father? It would be milliseconds. Thanks, Dad. Doesn't take very much. The other thing I love about this poem, I'm probably getting off subject here, but the other thing I love about this poem is that it really ends in a totally different place. It ends in a prayer. Helen Vindler, the great poetry critic and teacher, talked about maybe we should think about speech acts and not think about poetry as happening as being narrative, lyric, and dramatic, but thinking of speech acts for them, which I find much more helpful. And what a speech act can do, if you're aware of them, like one could be moving into prayer. Right? This is highly narrative here at the beginning. And then, if you know the poem well, the poem ends with speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices? And so there's a kind of turning away in some ways of consolation there. Like, my father did this for me. It wasn't the happiest of households, as you learn in the poem here, but my father did show me love. I just didn't know how to recognize that. And so, what a beautiful poem. I mean, so honest. It's not trying to candy coat what happened in the house, but at the end, it's like, I wish I had known, and I wish I had been able to express that to this father figure that I had, who I was always scared of.
Yeah,
I don't know what we were talking. I just went on and on, so I don't know what I was talking about.
that's
What you
wonderful. That's where the good teaching happens, I think.
asked.
Well, before I let you go, I want to ask, what is the best lesson you ever learned about poetry or writing in general?
I remember someone saying to me a long time ago, maybe in graduate school, that poems are made things. And so what we want to do is we want to draft with full abandon, I think, and just put everything in, kitchen sink, whatever, to be cliche, to be familiar with that. But then we want to come back, and it's not always just pulling things out, but it's deciding what to keep too is a sort of a making of a poem as well. And so, we need to remember that, especially I think as we're moving on in poetry practice, and maybe not in the beginning, but we need to remember that we are architects really of our poems. And we don't want to strip all the mystery out of our poems, but we want to make sure that we put them together in a way that's unified, that we understand we have control, taking something out, putting something in. And that could be a comma. I mean, I consider myself revising. If I take a comma out and then I come back later and put one in, that's two revisions in my mind. So, I don't, I think that poets attend to the world, and we watch things and we see things, and we try to communicate those things to people. And sometimes those things are mysterious as well. So learning how to balance those two things is another great lesson I learned, trying to not pull the mystery out of everything, because I have sort of a narrative bent, as we were talking about before, and I will try to make everything go from A to B to C to D, whatever. And I don't know, it just allow mystery. So those may be two sentiments that seem to be in opposition together. So poetry is our main thing, but we want to allow mystery too, I think, in our poems. And I don't know how coherent that is. There are two things that are on my mind lately, anyway. So.
Well, I've learned so much. I learn something every time that I have a conversation with you. You're just a natural teacher. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for asking me to come on and talk with you. I'll talk with you about, I don't know, baking brownies or whatever. It doesn't matter.
Pleasure. Thank you. Writing Lessons is an initiative of the 2024-2025 Kentucky Poet Laureate. That's me, Silas House. I'm thankful for the support of the Kentucky Arts Council, the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, the Office of Governor Andy Beshear, and Kentucky Humanities. This show is written, recorded, edited, and produced by me. I hope you will share the show with other writers, students, or anyone who is interested in the creative process. Please subscribe to our show, and if you like it, I hope you'll leave a review or a 5-star rating. That'll help us get the show to more listeners. Thanks so much for listening to Writing Lessons.